April 7, 1964. A stage in a hotel ballroom in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thomas Watson Jr., the chief executive of IBM, walks out under the lights to make what he calls, in the very first sentence of his speech, the most important product announcement in his corporation's history. Behind him, arranged in a long, careful row, sit six new computers, each one taller than a man and as wide as a small car. They are painted a clean, industrial gray. Their cabinets bear the new family name in modest type. The cameras roll. The announcement is broadcast simultaneously to more than 100,000 people in 165 cities. What the audience does not know, what almost nobody in the room knows, is that several of those gleaming machines behind Watson are not real. They're made of painted plywood. The actual hardware was not ready in time, and rather than miss the launch, somebody on the production team built fakes, painted them to match the working units, and arranged them so the broadcast cameras would catch the wide shot without anyone noticing. Watson is staking $5 billion of IBM money, more than the company's annual revenue, on this single line of computers. He has deliberately cannibalized every other product the company sells. The team behind him, Bob Evans on project direction, Gene Amble on the architecture, Fred Brooks on the software, has spent years building something that has never quite existed before. A family of computers, sized from small to enormous, each one capable of running the same software as the others. A small business could buy the cheapest one. A large bank could buy the most expensive one. The programs they wrote would move between them without needing to be rewritten. The machine had a name. It was called the System/360. The name was chosen because the machine was meant to cover the full 360 degrees of business computing, from the smallest job to the largest. And on that April afternoon, even with the plywood, the modern computer industry was effectively born. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 13, From Mainframes to the Desk. Today I want to walk you, gently, through how computers got from where they were in 1964, locked behind glass walls in cold air-conditioned rooms, attended by men in white shirts and narrow ties, to where they are today, sitting on your kitchen counter, in your pocket, on your wrist. By the end of this episode, you will have a picture of one of the most consequential rearrangements of power in the history of work. The computer moved from being a thing a corporation owned that you submitted requests to being a thing you owned that you told what to do. And the people who saw that shift coming before almost anyone else ended up shaping the next half century of how everything gets done. Let me set the scene properly. If you walked into a corporate computer room in the 1960s, the first thing you would notice was the cold. The room was kept between 65 and 75 degrees Fahrenheit because the machines threw off so much heat that without industrial refrigeration, they would melt themselves into uselessness. The floor was raised with perforated tiles and cold air pushed up from underneath in a constant low hum. The machines themselves were enormous. They sat in tall cabinets behind a glass wall. You did not touch them. You did not, in most cases, even see the people who did. The way you used a computer, if you needed one, was through a small rectangle of stiff cardstock called a punch card. The card was 3¼ inches by 7⅜ inches, with a diagonal cut on the top left corner so misfiled cards could be spotted by eye. Each card held one line of a program, or one record of data, encoded as patterns of small rectangular holes. You wrote your program on paper. You handed it to a key punch operator. The operator punched the cards on a special machine. You carried your stack of cards across the building to the computer center. You handed them through a window to an operator behind the glass, and you waited. Maybe an hour. Maybe a day. Sometimes longer. The operator fed your deck into a reader. The machine ran your program. And out came a stack of printed paper with your results. Or, much more often, with an error message that meant you had to start the whole process over again. There was a small printed warning on each card, three words long. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. The warning meant the machine could not read a damaged card. By the mid-1960s, that phrase had escaped the data center, made its way onto utility bills and student identification cards, and become, in the hands of student protesters at Berkeley, a button, "I am a student." Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. The slogan of the machine had been stolen by the machine's victims. A protest about being treated as a number on a card. That was computing for most of the people who used it for most of the years it had existed. Not yours. Not personal. Distant. Bureaucratic. Carefully rationed. The economics of all this were straightforward. A System/360 Model 30 rented for about $8,000 a month in 1965 dollars, which is roughly $80,000 a month in today's money. A larger model could rent for 10 times that. No individual person could afford a computer. No small business could afford a computer. Even most universities could only afford one for the entire campus, shared by every department, scheduled in the way you might schedule access to a telescope, with researchers signing up for blocks of time at the computer center and bringing their decks of cards at the appointed hour. The first crack in that arrangement, the first hint that something else might be possible, arrived in a New Mexico warehouse in January of 1975. The warehouse belonged to a company called MITS, run by a Florida-born Air Force engineer named Ed Roberts. Roberts had negotiated a price of $75 per chip with Intel for their new 8080 processor and had designed around it a small kit computer. The kit was named the Altair 8800 after a Star Trek episode that the editor's 12-year-old daughter happened to be watching the week they needed a name. The Altair had 40 switches on the front, blinking red lights, no keyboard, no screen, and no software. It cost $397. It landed on the cover of Popular Electronics in January of 1975, and the box pictured on the cover was, in fact, empty because the only real prototype had been lost in a railway shipping strike on its way to New York. Roberts told his banker he might sell 800 units in a year. He got over 1,000 orders in February alone, 2,500 by May. 40,000 before he sold the company 3 years later. Nobody had expected this. Roberts was not, by training or temperament, a revolutionary. He had built what he thought might be a hobby kit for engineers. What he had actually built was the first computer a person could own. Not a corporation. Not a university. A person, in their living room, hooked to a typewriter, or to a paper tape, or very quickly, to a homemade keyboard. Suddenly, there was an entire population of people, mostly young, mostly self-taught, who could afford a computer and could spend their evenings doing whatever they wanted with it. Two of those people were named Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. They built their first computer, the Apple I, in a garage in Los Altos, California, in 1976. Wozniak designed it. To fund the first run of about 200 units, Jobs sold his Volkswagen van and Wozniak sold his Hewlett-Packard calculator. They priced the machine at $666.66 because Wozniak liked repeating digits and it happened to be a one-third markup on the wholesale cost. The Apple II followed on April 16, 1977, at the West Coast Computer Fair in San Francisco. 12,750 attendees. Color graphics. A foam-molded plastic case Jobs had insisted on. A switching power supply designed by Rod Holt. It looked, for the first time, like a finished product instead of a kit. The rainbow apple on the side was a tribute to the color graphic circuit that Wozniak had hand-designed. Within 4 years, every major company in computing realized something was happening that they did not control. On August 12, 1981, at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, IBM held a press conference and unveiled the IBM personal computer. It cost $1,565 in its base configuration. It had been designed in 12 months by a small team in Boca Raton, Florida, led by William Lowe and Don Estridge, who had been given unusual freedom by headquarters precisely because nobody at IBM believed personal computers were a real business yet. To hit the timeline, the Boca Raton team did something unprecedented for IBM. They used off-the-shelf parts. They used a processor from Intel. And they came to a small software company in Albuquerque looking for an operating system. That small software company was Microsoft. And here is one of the most consequential business decisions of the 20th century, the kind of decision that almost nobody noticed at the time it was made. Microsoft did not actually have an operating system to sell. Bill Gates and his partner Paul Allen knew about a system called 86DOS, written by a programmer named Tim Patterson at Seattle Computer Products. Gates licensed 86DOS for $25,000, later bought it outright for a total of about $75,000, hired Patterson to port it for IBM, and, crucially, kept the right to license that operating system to anyone else who wanted to build a personal computer. IBM signed. They thought they were buying software. They were, in fact, handing Microsoft the next 30 years of the industry. Because within a few years, dozens of other companies began making machines that ran the same DOS. Compaq, the first major one, shipped a machine in 1983 that was functionally identical to the IBM PC but cheaper, and the lawyers at IBM could find nothing to sue over because Compaq had carefully reverse-engineered the small piece of code IBM had written while licensing the DOS underneath for Microsoft directly. Dell followed. HP followed. Gateway followed. Every one of them paid Microsoft a license fee for every machine they sold. IBM, who had paid Microsoft to write the software, was suddenly competing against every other company that ran it. The licensing clause Gates had insisted on, in a contract negotiated by a small team in Albuquerque, became one of the most valuable pieces of business writing ever committed to paper. The deeper pattern, the one underneath all of this, is the inversion. Computing went from being something a small number of large institutions did, on machines you could not touch, to something almost every person did, on machines they owned. The shift moved power. It moved money. It moved the entire center of gravity of the industry from the data center to the desk. And the companies who saw it first, who bet on it before it was obvious, who treated the personal computer not as a hobbyist toy, but as the future shape of work, those companies became the largest businesses in human history. Microsoft, Apple, Intel, the names that by 1990 had reorganized the world. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that computing was not always personal. For most of its history, it was a thing institutions owned and rationed behind a glass wall, fed punch cards by attendants. The idea that you would own a computer, that it would live in your house, that you would tell it what to do directly, is a new idea, is younger than your parents. The second is that the personal computer was not invented by IBM. It was invented by hobbyists in garages and warehouses on kitchen tables building kits in the evenings because they wanted to. The largest companies in the industry only joined later, and only because the hobbyists had proven there was a market. The third is that the most important business decision of the entire transition, the licensing clause that Bill Gates kept in the IBM contract, took up about two sentences in a single document. Most of the consequential decisions in technology turn out to be small and quiet and visible only later. Next time on Rust, gently, we will follow the wire. We will sit down beside a 21-year-old programmer in a basement at UCLA. On the night of October 29th, 1969, as he types the first two letters ever sent across the ancestor of the internet. We will watch the open protocols beat the closed networks, and we will ask the question of why open one. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.